But you seem to know it all off the top of your head when I was quizzing you earlier, so.
Let me turn this on and off.
I don't think we have powers.
Is Michael coming or is he checking his
He's checking here. Is it bottom?
Michael.
This thing doesn't turn off.
It looks like the middle one.
Yeah, my middle one doesn't turn off either.
So that one's just different.
Yeah.
I guess we're just expecting it's up. It's up. Just make sure you want it.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hope you're having a good event so far. My name is Svetlana Gans. I'm a partner at Gibson Dunn and the chair of the Antitrust Executive Committee of Federalist Society. It's great to see you all here. And thank you for not going to the other room for the other panel with an unnamed person who is very important. So antitrust is all the rage, and we hope you are all interested in antitrust issues, and that's why you're here. The Antitrust Executive Committee has a wealth of programs, webinars, fireside chats, blog posts, and other things related to antitrust, both on the merger, non-merger, FTC, DOJ side. So we hope that if you are interested in antitrust issues, if you could contact me at sgans@gibsondunn.com or Nate Kaczmarnak to get more involved in the committee. We have a wealth of opportunities for folks interested in antitrust, whether you're a law student, young lawyer, or a more senior practitioner. So please be in touch if you are interested in antitrust issues. This panel is about the consumer welfare. Is it alive or dead, and where do we go from here? I am honored and privileged to introduce the moderator of today's panel, Chief Judge of the Fifth Circuit, Honorable Jennifer Walker Elrod. Prior to serving as Chief Judge, Judge Elrod was appointed and then twice elected judge of the 190th District Court of Harris County, Texas, where she spent over 5 years presiding in over more than 200 jury and non-jury trials. In private practice, the Chief Judge focused on civil litigation, antitrust, and employment matters. She has issued significant rulings while on the court, including the 2022 Jarchese matter that held SEC's in-house adjudication unconstitutional. So thank you, Your Honor, for being here and moderating this panel, and I will leave you all in good hands. Thank you.
Thank you for that very overly generous introduction, and thank you for doing so much work for this group. This group, again, this practice group is the Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, and we're here to talk about the future of antitrust. Do you think we have a bright future, gentlemen, in antitrust? Yes? Thumbs up?
So.
A lot going
Absolutely.
On? Good, good, good. Seeing this full room reminds me of something. Before I became a federal judge, I was once a fledgling law student who wanted to be an antitrust lawyer. I had the good sense to take Professor Phil Arita's contracts and antitrust classes. I had the poor sense to sing to him on the last day of class, "Don't call on me, Phil Arita," to the tune of "Don't cry for me, Argentina." But he did laugh. I soon learned that it was difficult to be a fledgling antitrust lawyer in Houston, although we had some my very fine mentors. But I realized that a lot of the action was in D.C., which I guess some people call the swamp, but I wanted to stay in the actual swamp in Houston, Texas. So with that, I left my desire to be an antitrust lawyer, but I still keep a copy of antitrust law developments on the shelf in my chambers because I just have to keep subscribing. It seems kind of like the Bible, and it's easy to refer to, or the cliff notes of the Bible, maybe. This antitrust is a growing field, as has been alluded to now. I met two students in the elevator. Where are you, two students in the elevator? They told me they were coming, and they said that they're both taking antitrust this semester, and they were hoping this would help them for their finals. So, yeah, so it's going to be up to you. Much of the recent interest in antitrust stems from intellectual and policy challenges to the consumer welfare standard, the reigning legal framework in antitrust lawyer. Whether it's from the right, left, or center, there is certainly great interest in the future of antitrust law and policy. One might even say that debating antitrust today is hip. I like to think that maybe they are all just like economics, but indeed, last night during the fireside chat with the justices could talk about almost nothing else besides antitrust. They talked about the airline deregulation and Justice Breyer's work in that in a prior life, and also with Justice Gorsuch in a prior life, his practice in antitrust. And so who knew that we would get a shout out at that dinner? This brings us to our subject today. The consumer welfare standard has come under fire in recent years from across the ideological spectrum. Critics have argued that the consumer welfare standard is outdated, leads to under-enforcement, fails to take into account social or political considerations, and imposes neoclassical economics on the text of the federal antitrust standards. Meanwhile, the standard's proponents have argued that it provides an even playing field, encourages regulatory and judicial restraint, and reflects economic realities. This learned panel, and this is a learned panel, will discuss and debate these aspects of antitrust lawyer and as they talk about the future of antitrust law. I think it will be with us forever, perhaps, and we will still be talking about competitiveness and economic growth. Michael Cadis is a Deputy Assistant Attorney General, and he's on the panel today, for the Antitrust Division with a focus on civil enforcement. Prior to coming to the U.S. Department of Justice, Michael was Director for Markets and Competition Policy at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Michael previously worked as antitrust counsel for Senator Amy Klobuchar on detail from the Federal Trade Commission, where he spent 20 years investigating and litigating antitrust actions as an attorney. Please welcome Michael.
Thank you for that. Very.
Thank you.
Oh, you can go ahead. No,
you go ahead and talk. That's fine. I was going to introduce everybody else, but
you
talk. Go, go.
Okay. It only took me 10 seconds to talk over a federal judge. That's really not.
It happens all the time.
No, thank you very much for having me. I don't know what to make of the fact that I am seated the farthest to the right at a panel at the Federalist Society. When we were preparing for this before the election, I said, you know, I may be the person with the least insight of what to think about the future of antitrust. And that prediction turns out to be, I think, true. I just wanted to make some sort of broad points, really, despite the panel being the future of antitrust, actually looking back over what in the Biden administration, at least speaking only for the Department of Justice, what I see is sort of what's salient. And one thing about antitrust that I think is very salient is it may be the only issue left in the American society that is bipartisan, both those people who want more antitrust enforcement and those who do not. It crosses party lines. That's a very pleasant place to be in a world where where your party identity is often defines who you are. This is an area where we really don't, where it doesn't. So I think that's a very good thing about antitrust enforcement and hope that that continues. As I look back, and we're talking about the consumer welfare standard, and when the neo-Brandeisians sort of exploded onto the scene in 2016, I remember having conversations with them being, I don't think the consumer welfare standard is necessarily the problem with antitrust. And then they would say things like, well, the consumer welfare standard only applies to price. And I would say, let me be clear. 20 years at the FTC, I never sat in a room where we were like, we have this great case, but it's our evidence is all about quality, so we're not going to bring it. Generally, we were bringing the cases we were bringing because you often have your price evidence as your best evidence. So similarly, today, I'm going to say the reverse, which is I don't, to the degree someone does not like what the Biden administration has done, it is not about an abandonment of the consumer welfare standard. It should be about what do the antitrust laws prohibit and how effective were the agencies in accomplishing that. I very much believe that our job as an enforcer is you interpret the statute. It's up to Congress to change it if they want to change it. And, you know, what I would say really about the change I see from the Biden from the past is, number one, the least talked about, but at least I think the most important, is that Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Cantor has found a way to leverage the division's resources beyond what anybody thought could be done. We have 8 civil litigations going on right now. We have 4 major Section 2 cases. The courts will decide whether we're right or wrong, but for a long time, people at the agencies thought if you could do 2 merger cases at once, you were superheroes. What we have done, and I, again, staff deserves 90% of the credit, and Jonathan about 9.5, and the rest of his deputies, negative 0.2, because we just create problems. But seriously, I think that really that is arguably maybe the most lasting impact is what the horizon, what you can do with your resources. The second, I think, is a willingness to be far less risk averse, and being willing to take on cases where you think you're right, but you don't think you have a 95% chance of winning, which relates to the second. And the third is, I think, right, the biggest break with the past is we are far more skeptical of merger settlements, and this is obviously an area people can disagree with. What I would say about the benefits of that policy is, one, most importantly, it means we have to be willing to go to court if we want to bring a case. We cannot hold companies hostage. And as a 20-year FTC veteran, I will tell you, there were lots of times consents came up. And in particular, my least favorite moment as a federal employee was I was working for Commissioner Leibowitz. Consent came up. I read the memo. I read it twice. I think, for those of you who know me, I am not one to shy away from aggressive theories. And I read it a third time, and I still couldn't figure out what the theory is. I called up the parties, and I was like, I don't understand what's going on here. There can't be a violation. And the word I got was, oh, there's no violation, but please just approve this deal so we can move on. And that is an embarrassment when the government does that. So I'll kind of stop there, let people take shots at what I've put up there. But I do think if we're thinking about what the future is and what's happened, I think thinking about what the agencies did is a little more important than the rhetoric that sometimes comes out of them.
Thank you, Michael. What an important reminder as we begin today. We have now Chris Mufarrige, and who is the Chief of Staff and Attorney Advisor to Commissioner Melissa Holyoke, who is here with us today. Welcome, Commissioner. Before that, Chris was in private practice in Wilson Sonsini's Antitrust Practice Group. He also served as senior advisor to the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and was a counsel at the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. Chris, do you have some opening remarks for us?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. And thank you to the Federalist Society for putting on this timely panel. And thank you to Judge Elrod for moderating. Just to get some housekeeping out of the way, the views I express are my own and do not represent those of the Federal Trade Commission. I want to briefly touch on 3 issues that I hope we can discuss in more detail during today's conversation. To begin with, first principles are key to the effective administration of any body of law, particularly one as generally applicable as antitrust. So if we hope to effectively administer antitrust law, we must articulate a coherent set of principles that the public can rely on. First principles serve to provide clarity and predictability, not just for the public, but also for the agency staff who enforce the law. Second, and relatedly, rhetoric matters. If repeated enough, wrong ideas, particularly about business practices that affect our everyday lives, become a part of our baseline understanding of how the world works. And because antitrust has such an outsized effect on our market economy, it is critical that we speak accurately and objectively about the ideas that animate antitrust. For the last 4 years, we have seen antitrust rhetoric used as a cudgel to attack, often baselessly, lawful business practices. Such attacks undermine the moral and intellectual legitimacy of our country's free market economy. That is a problem, and not just a theoretical one. Misguided rhetoric leads to misguided policy and enforcement, which ultimately hurts the American people. Finally, it is no accident that we have seen these types of attacks the last 4 years in particular. Indeed, an important goal, a first principle that has animated the various political groups pushing for radical changes in the administration of the antitrust laws over the last 4 years, has been the general notion of equality of outcomes. But competition, properly understood, rejects the protection of rivals as an end unto itself. Competition means that some businesses will perform better than others and expect to benefit accordingly. It rewards the firms that compete the best and the entrepreneurs that best satisfy the preferences of consumers. Of course, competition necessarily means that there are winners and losers, and we should welcome such consequences so long as the competitive process serves American consumers. Thank you, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you very much, Chris. Next, we have on our panel Thomas DiMatteo, who is counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee to Ranking Member Lee of the Competition Policy, Antitrust, and Consumer Rights Subcommittee. He previously served as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice Antitrust Division, where he worked closely with leadership and staff on civil merger and non-merger matters across numerous industries, including large technology platforms, defense, finance, and consumer products. Tom, do you have some opening remarks for us today?
Thanks very much, Judge Elrod.
Thank you.
And thank you for the Federalist Society for having me today. It's a true honor. Just like Chris, I have a disclaimer. My views today are only those of myself. They don't represent Senator Lee or any one of the Judiciary Committee or any senator or congresspeople. So antitrust is clearly having a moment, which is exciting for those who are in antitrust and those new to antitrust. As Judge Elrod mentioned last night at the dinner, it was a little surprising to see antitrust actually take the stage, and it's really fun. So let's think about what antitrust is, and we talk about the consumer welfare standard. Well, why are we discussing that? It's because the antitrust laws, at least on the civil side, the Sherman and Clayton Act, right, they are about a tweet long, maybe a little longer than that, but they're not really that long of laws. So, and on the merger side, merger cases don't frequently go to the Supreme Court because of the way deals are put together and financing and the cost of litigation. So the consumer welfare standard helps inform us on how to view mergers and conduct, and it's the guiding principle of how agencies and courts should be looking at antitrust potential infractions. What is the consumer welfare and standard, and what is it not? It's not just being tethered to price effects. That's not what it is. It's not that the government always wins. It's not that the government always loses. It's to have a coherent principle to focus on when the agencies review deals and bring conduct matters. It does not mean that. If you were to scrap the consumer welfare standard and go to something new, which I think is the wrong approach, we turn into a regulatory approach that's based on feelings and social agendas, and that is not the way the antitrust laws are meant to be enforced. So look forward to today's discussion. There's certainly a lot of areas that antitrust impacts across our economy, and there's antitrust problems in a lot of industries that need to be evaluated. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tom, for this opening remarks. Next, we have Adam, and you need to remind me, Sela. He's the chief counsel at the House Judiciary Committee for Antitrust, Regulatory, and Administrative Law. Prior to joining the Judiciary Committee, he was attorney advisor to Commissioner Christine S. Wilson at the U.S. Federal Trade Commissioner. Prior to joining the FTC, he worked in antitrust law in private practice. Adam, do you have some wise words for us?
I definitely have some words. I hope they are wise.
Adam's words are always wise. So
we'll see about that. Thank you. Thank you for that kind introduction. Thank you for the Federalist Society for having us and all my co-panelists. And like the other government co-panelists, I'm speaking on behalf of myself and no one else today. So when we're talking about the future of antitrust, and we're obviously talking about consumer-focused antitrust, consumer welfare standard, as some people like to call it, what I would say is that antitrust is not supposed to be static, even within the consumer welfare standard. It moves forward, it develops as we understand modern economics, modern markets, and as common law develops. So we do not have to move beyond consumer-focused antitrust. And I agree with Michael, I don't think that the Biden administration has, in its actual antitrust enforcement, abandoned a consumer-focused antitrust enforcement regime. So within that, and we're talking about the future of antitrust, we're obviously looking at a world where the next Trump administration is going to define the future of antitrust. So I'd just like to highlight two areas where I think the Trump administration can and should move antitrust forward within a consumer-focused framework. And I think the first area is in collusion. In antitrust and collusion, we have largely focused on naked restraints of trade, like price fixing, and rightfully so. Price fixing is the supreme evil of antitrust. It raises prices for consumers. But we have also seen collusion, especially in the trade association space, that has had significant harms to American consumers. And we've done a lot of this work in the Judiciary Committee, and Chairman Jordan was able to unearth a lot of this using his subpoena power. But we have seen it in by the major financial institutions and asset managers. We have seen under the umbrella guise of ESG coordination, we have seen coordination or collusion to limit the output of oil and gas for Americans, which increases prices. And this is and should be illegal and a focus of the future Trump administration. If you are raising prices for American consumers, this should be illegal coordination under the antitrust laws. We've also seen this similarly in a way that limits choice for Americans in advertising collusion. We have seen advertising associations with major advertisers and advertising agencies focusing on group boycotts to limit funding for X because they didn't like Elon Musk, or cut funding for Spotify and advertising for Spotify because they didn't like Joe Rogan. Limiting choice for Americans can be illegal if it is collusion under the antitrust laws, and this should be a focus of the next administration. The one other space I would like to suggest can be a focus of moving law forward, still within protecting consumers, is supply chain resiliency, especially in merger review. We all have realized over the last 4 years, especially in the pandemic, what can happen when our supply chains are fragile. And I think in merger review, we have not thought about this enough, because a merger that makes our supply chains fragile might not look like it's going to do anything to consumers over the next day or two. But in a year or two, when something bad happens, it could have devastating impacts for consumers. And this is an area where a merger litigation focusing on this and actually winning a case would really move merger enforcement forward in the future. So obviously, the Trump administration and who he picks for these positions are going to make these decisions about what is the focus. But I think even within a consumer-focused antitrust regime, we can see significant movement of antitrust law forward over the next 4 years.
Sounds exciting, is it?
As Tom said, it's a very exciting time to be an antitrust
lawyer. Next, we have Alex Oculiar, who is co-chair of Morrison Foerster's Global Antitrust Law Practice Group. He is the former Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Civil Antitrust Enforcement at the U.S. Department of Justice, and a former advisor at the FTC. His practice includes litigation, merger reviews, and government investigations. Are you going to be busy?
Maybe. Well, thank you, Judge, and thanks, everyone, for having me here today. I appreciate it. So I'm just going to sort of layer on to a few of the other comments that I heard earlier. We used to have what we used to call the Washington consensus or the Washington approach to antitrust. And generally speaking, people refer to it in shorthand as the consumer welfare standard, but what it really meant was that we believed in the protection of freedom to trade and economic freedom because we thought it would help sustain political freedom and prosperity, right? And in trying to achieve those goals, we had some what I'll call first principles or basic principles that we tried to adhere to in governance. And what I'm referring to in particular is when I was with both the FTC and the DOJ, we looked to make sure that we had transparency, right? So we advocated for transparency with the people that were in front of us, which is really all market participants. People should know where the line is, right? Where they could end up running afoul of the law. So we believed in transparency. We believed in predictability and certainty, right? So again, you should be able to understand where your deal or your conduct is going to run into problems under the law. And then we also believed in impartiality under the law, fairness. And it was an enforcement-based approach, right, where we would have to go to court to someone that was independent and advocate for our position as an enforcer. That was kind of seen as the Washington consensus, again, loosely speaking. And we'll talk more about the consumer welfare standard and what that actually means shortly. But I think it's important to highlight that at the outset because I think that there's been a movement away from that over the last, particularly the last few years, but even beyond that. And there's been a sort of a gravitation to more of a, what I'll call a Brussels-style approach to antitrust or to competition more broadly speaking. And that approach is really more prescriptive. It is more focused on regulation. And it also allows for blending of things like privacy, industrial policy, and other concepts into antitrust. So there are non-economic factors that are filtering into antitrust analysis. And that's something that really we hadn't seen in any great measure until fairly recently in the U.S. U.S. enforcers, I think, while there is still some economic grounding to some of the enforcement actions that are brought, really are thinking more about industrial policy and other social, political goals in making decisions about antitrust enforcement. In terms of predicting the future of antitrust, right, so now we have a new administration that's going to be taking office here soon, I would anticipate that what you're going to see is maybe a little bit more of a move back towards a Washington consensus, but similar to what was true under Trump, sort of 1.0, I guess is what people are saying. And in my role there in the antitrust division, we were very aggressive. We had a sort of robust, muscular antitrust enforcement, but it was very much hewing to the Washington consensus and focused on consumer welfare. Right, so some of the cases that you might be reading about today were actually cases, well, I'll mention like the Google search case that we brought under the late sort of Trump administration, right? And those types of cases were grounded in kind of a consumer welfare approach that really focused on economic factors and the potential impact on competition and consumers. So I think that's a direction we're gonna probably go back toward. Right, so it's going to continue to be robust enforcement, but it's going to be more economics-based enforcement, evidence-based enforcement. I think you're also going to see a lot more clarity offered for the marketplace. Right, the current administration pulled back on some of the informal guidance and the formal guidance that have been out there for the marketplace. Well, I view that as a bad idea. You need to tell people where there's going to be a problem so they can self-regulate as best possible. So I think you're going to see more guidance offered to the marketplace, even just by reinstituting guidelines that have been pulled back by the current administration, really just reposting those and making those available and no longer disavowing them. So I think we're moving in that direction. So it'll be robust, but a little bit more economics-based, and non-economic factors will play far less of a role in the approach to antitrust going forward. That's my prediction.
Thanks, Alex. That's very helpful. Does anyone have any responses or concerns or questions for each other before we move along? I have a few questions, but I wanted to make sure that you have a chance to respond or if you want to engage one of your panel members.
I think we can.
You want to move on?
I'm fine moving on.
Okay.
I'm not really sure whether I'm in the same universe as these gentlemen, but that's
okay. Fair enough. Well, just in case somebody's wandered into the room, who says, I have to go to a panel. I don't know which one to go into, or I meant to be in the other room, and I'm not sure. We've said the word consumer welfare standard about 25 times at least, and I'm not sure we've said what we're talking about. And I know that Assistant Attorney General Cantor likes to say that if you ask five antitrust experts what the consumer welfare standard means, you will get six different answers. What is the consumer welfare standard? Anybody?
Let me defend my boss, if that's all right. And what he's pointing out there, right, if you take high school microeconomics, what they would say is the consumer welfare is the difference between what you are willing to pay as a consumer for a product or services and what you did pay. So I'm kind of crazy and like really like good beef, like good steak, I would pay a lot for it. So to the degree it's less than that reserve price, that's my consumer welfare of that transaction. Okay. Does that animate antitrust? Well, I don't know because, you know, I'm not going to – let me talk about a scholar. I apologize to someone you're not familiar with, but it was a judge, Judge Robert Bork. Oh, come on. That was kind of funny. but, right, what Judge Bork said when he said consumer welfare was he wanted to conclude both what the consumer benefits from the transaction and the producer. That's an entirely different structure. You've heard this. So we have, it's called the consumer welfare standard. Does it only apply to consumers? Does it apply to sellers and employers? I think I hear from this panel that it should, and it does. It's just a little weird to have a standard that you say is the consumer standard but applies to monopsony. That's just weird. It makes it really hard for people to understand what's going on. Similarly, does it apply to quality? Of course it should. Do people understand it if you're not an expert and you haven't read the 18,000 articles about the consumer welfare standard? No. So I think that's why Jonathan's saying the consumer welfare standard means so many different things that it is not a helpful way to understand how to apply the antitrust laws.
Okay. Anyone want to respond?
I mean, I think that that's – I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I do think that there's a way to boil it down, at least in my mind. There's really sort of – I think Judge Bork viewed it as promotion of economic efficiency across the economy. So irrespective of who ended up receiving those efficiency gains, ultimately we are all better off because the economy is more efficient.
So why not just call it the efficiency standard?
Well, there's two sort of views, right? That's one that people talk about. And the second one is sort of preventing the transfer of wealth from one group to another, right? So from buyers to sellers by virtue of increased prices or reductions in quality or innovation, right? Those are sort of two competing views, I think, of the consumer welfare standard.
Do you think if there's a monopsony case where it would reduce output in the line of commerce that you're examining, but it would benefit consumers, that's a case you should bring?
Under the statute? Oh, I remember, yes. Absolutely. The statute does not say that all we care about is the final consumer, and two, theoretically, it's really hard to figure out when that would be true, mm-hmm. right? Because what is a monopsonist does, right? Monopsonist buys less to lower price. For that to help consumers, they have to sell more. So how is it that you're buying less but selling more?
That's the question. It's usually pretty consistent.
Right. But even if it wasn't, the law makes it clear that we are concerned mm-hmm. with restraints of trade. We are not social engineers. We are not doing balancing. We are concerned with mergers and mergers affecting any market. That's the statute.
Right. But you'd have to draw the market around just, you know, if in the instance of maybe like the workers for a particular merger that's being affected, you'd have to draw it narrowly enough to exclude the consumers.
I think, to your point,
you just said, though, it's usually consistent with one another that if the monopsony exists, it's probably going to harm consumers. So they go directionally more often than not with one another.
They do, but what should be defining this discussion is the statute.
Right, but you have to define the market in such a way to exclude.
Yes. I think who would define a market to say the realm of competition here is competition for employees and competition for this product? That's your market.
Nobody would. Well,
nobody would. You'd be laughed out of court.
Well, I've heard it rhetorically at least be presented that way.
Find me a single case that has defined a market that broadly.
No, I agree with you. I agree. So, but the rhetoric matters, though, right?
No.
Why does it not matter?
It matters. What we do is what matters. Nobody is going to read a speech by Michael Katus come January 22nd or Jonathan Cantor. What matters is the cases you bring and whether you win or lose.
You don't think
and
that,
by that definition, right, if you want, I mean, I've heard lots of people saying that we're off the rocker. Tell me which one of our cases was not consistent with the laws. We may lose on the facts, but every single case we have brought, as someone who has spent 20 years in antitrust, I firmly believe that they are all on sound legal grounds. And to suggest that somehow we are legislating, quite the contrary. We're actually trying to just interpret the statute. And
thank you. Thank you, Michael.
Sorry.
And Chris.
Sorry.
No, this is great. Who did you know that antitrust could be spicy? It can be. Is it appropriate to ask the question that Michael's asking? Does this matter, this discussion about monopsony? And I have to say, it's very exciting to hear somebody talking about monopsony. I very rarely hear that these days. What are some examples of some cases brought in the last 4 years that some believe were intended to accomplish an enforcement goal not aligned with the consumer welfare standard? Or is there any meat on the bones there?
Sure. I mean, I'm going to stick with the commission since that's where it's monopolized my focus for the last year. But two cases where Commissioner Holyoake dissented on were two recent oil and merger cases, Exxon Pioneer and Chevron Hess, and they very clearly were not in the consumer welfare standard world. I mean, it was just a situation where the majority in both cases alleged that communications from the respective CEOs in each deal were problematic, and I'm being very, very generous in that description, right? And they suggested that elevating both to the boards of the merged company would substantially lessen competition. So those two by themselves, I think, very clearly fall in those lines. The unfair methods of competition policy statement that came out during this administration very clearly doesn't fall within the consumer welfare standard either.
Do you want to respond? Or?
So let me just say, when everybody else said, I speak on behalf, but not for my agency, it turns out, based on the legal counsel's opinion, I do speak for the Department of Justice. So I'm not going to talk about the FTC, because that would be an official view of the Department of Justice of the FTC, and we have enough internal, I should be clear. I am focused on what we have done. And like, if you think the FTC has gone off the rails, that's absolutely. I do not have a response, both because I can't say anything, but also because it's not what I focused on. But as to the Department of Justice cases, there you can beat me up all you want.
Tom, perhaps you could come into the discussion. I have a question for you. I know that Vice President-elect Vance and Senator Hawley and maybe Senator Lee. And others have been critical of an approach to antitrust enforcement that emphasizes consumer prices alone. Are they correct? How will these perspectives affect enforcement in the future?
So if I can just maybe respond to some of this exciting.
Certainly.
Michael, I think rhetoric does matter, because think about the antitrust enforcement agencies have purview over every deal over a certain 110-ish million dollar threshold. So when companies are putting together deals and they're looking at new administrations, speeches are these guideposts for these companies to think about, is my deal going to get a second request that costs millions and millions of dollars? I don't think it's just the case law. It's the totality of what the agencies are saying, their approaches that they're bringing to bear actually, you know, moves a lot of money to the tune of billions, trillions of dollars in our economy. So I do think rhetoric has a pretty large implication, especially on the deal side, of what happens in antitrust enforcement. And then, you know, you talk about FTC and DOJ inefficiencies. You know, I started my career as a paralegal at DOJ, and the first question I asked is, why do we have two federal agencies fighting each other for work? When someone tries to merge, they have to file jointly with the FTC and DOJ. And it's an HSR filing, which both agencies have now actually increased what's required under the HSR files. That's going to cost our economy a lot of money. And it's important to keep in mind that over 95% of deals are approved without going to extra process. So one way to make this whole process more efficient is to actually have perhaps one agency that just reviews mergers so that it's very clear where the deal is going and it's very clear where how the deal is going to be reviewed, because right now FTC and DOJ have two different standards when they go into court to block a merger.
How would that be accomplished?
Well, it can be accomplished through legislation. Adam and I have there are two bills out there, both in the House and Senate, that would, there's one agency act that would create one agency and fold the FTC's competition authority into the Department of Justice. And it would at least give, as Alex talked about, predictability, transparency to folks who don't have antitrust issues with their deals. And again, that's over 95%. You know, the Biden administration took away early termination of mergers that don't have any problems. That's where someone reviews the HSR filing and says, boy, this doesn't present any competitive overlaps. This isn't a problem. Let's approve it. That's great because it also frees up resources so more people can review and work on the deals that actually present problems. So the One Agency Act is a great way to synthesize some of these issues. I mean, if you were starting from scratch, no one would say we want two government agencies doing the exact same thing. It just doesn't make sense.
Does anyone want to say a counterpoint to that? Or?
I feel like I will be the counterpoint always, and I don't want to dominate the discussion.
Well, we're really glad to have you here today.
Let me just try to be very quick. So the reason we have two agencies is because in 1912, Woodrow Wilson was elected president on the policy that the Department of Justice and the federal courts had gutted the Sherman and the Clayton Act, the Sherman Act. That's why we have it. There's no doubt about that. That was a congressional intent. I would say that doesn't mean we have to have two agencies forever, but that's a policy judgment, right? You know, I don't have much to say about that. If Congress wants to get rid of one of the two agencies, then Congress should do so. If Congress wants to say you should only look at these things in under the antitrust, they can do that, but that is a legislative decision.
No, it is, but a lot has happened since then, and I think there is a robust debate going on right now about whether or not it is appropriate for one agency to argue that they have a lower standard to meet to enjoin a merger. I think there's a robust debate going on right now that's appropriate about whether or not one agency should be able to bring cases in their own internal tribunal relative to the other agency that has to go to federal court to win its cases. So I agree, you know, you're right, of course, on the facts, but there's been a lot of intervening changes in terms of the way we think about these internal tribunals. And there's also the separate question of, you know, if the commission is focused on simply, you know, rhetorically going after businesses rather than focusing its resources on expert reports that actually dispassionately and objectively look at what business is doing, it should. I think these are good things and good debates to be had to figure out whether or not, you know, some of these bills make sense.
And I'll what just, expert reports are you reading?
From us?
No, just and like it's in litigation. Expert reports on both sides are not objective.
No, but the commission was founded in part.
Got it. Sorry, I misunderstood your point. Got it. Okay.
Adam, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I'll just add that when the commission and the DOJ Antitrust Division largely were founded to not be the same, doing the same functions. And now they largely do the exact same function. They just split up businesses, they split up industries, and they do the exact same thing under a different set of rules and pretend largely to have the same rules. As the FTC has started to expand from those kind of norms, they have not only had pushback from Congress, and maybe it's time to consider the One Agency Act, but they've also had pushback in the courts, meaning that the courts are raising a lot of constitutional and statutory questions for the first time. So if Congress does not step in and fix this problem, if it is a problem, then we may have a much weaker or non-existent FTC and then weaker antitrust enforcement at the federal level, which I don't think any of us ultimately want.
And I would just add very quickly that, you know, I agree ultimately this is a legislative decision, right, whether we have two agencies or not. And again, Tom and Adam are thinking about that. But there are ways that leadership of the two agencies, you know, in lieu of legislative action could help to eliminate the inefficiencies in having these two agencies with overlapping jurisdiction. You can have, for example, clearance. Clearance is always a big issue. There's often clearance disputes between the agencies as to which deals they're going to review. If you have sort of a more rational sort of clearance process, right, a system that's worked out between the agencies that's clear across them, that will allow for faster clearance and eliminate problems. That has been tried over time. I think Tim Muris did that with Charles James like 25 years ago. I'm looking at you, Alden, you might remember that. But, you know, that's a long time ago, and it seemed to work at least for a period of time.
Do you know what happened to that agreement?
Yeah, I do. But like,
it was never effectuated because some folks up on the Hill didn't like.
That's right. And so that's the point, right, is that ultimately someone who comes in should be able to implement something like that and have sort of a smoother clearance process. That's one way to do it. Another way that we talked about when I was at the FTC that was being discussed in Congress was the Smarter Act with respect to the difference in burdens that the agencies have to carry when they go to federal court to try to block a deal. Right. Ultimately, they're both enforcing the same law in that regard, and so there really shouldn't be, in my opinion, a different standard between them. Okay, so that's another thing that when I was at the agency, we took steps at the FTC to try to adhere to a similar or the same standard as the DOJ in going to court, and it's something that the commissioners at the time spoke about and testified on, and ultimately the Smarter Act, which was being considered at the time to change the standard expressly for the FTC, didn't get passed. Right. So there are ways that leadership of the two agencies can actually work together to harmonize their work as much as possible and to try to eliminate some of the, I think, inherent inefficiencies in having two agencies.
Maybe one final point there. Alex's point about clearance. The document that says which agency gets which industry regarding a merger, this isn't a public document. It's impossible unless you hire, you know, antitrust counsel at a big law firm to figure out where your deal is going to go in certain industries. So to Alex's point about transparency and predictability, you know, maybe that's one step the agencies could take is actually putting in a public-facing document saying if your deal is in this industry and involving these products, your deal is going to end up at the FTC or DOJ. And they can do that unilaterally without a legislative fix.
That's right. And the last time I think I searched for that, the one that came up was the one that Muris and James had talked about decades ago.
So as a lifetime agency employee, let me, you know, every administration in my lifetime has said, we're going to fix clearance. They have all more or less failed. I think objectively this administration has done a better job, but I think that just has to do with the personality, right? Anyone should understand if you have two decision makers, everybody wants the big sexy case, and that you can, you know, and, so just to lighten the mood, when I was attorney advisor to Chairman Leibowitz, and let's just say the relationship between the two agencies was not ideal, and we were talking about the clearance, my solution was if there is a fight and whoever wins that fight, the other side gets a trump card. They can just hold it for wherever they want, and then they can just take a deal. Because then it means if you really fight for something, you're going to lose something else. I was never invited to another clearance discussion ever, so success. In this role, whenever clearance came up, my standard response is, you know what the problem with the clearance is? The other agency. It's always the other agency wherever you are. They stopped inviting me to clearance discussions. So,
yeah.
You know, so I share the frustration on clearance, and I view it as a personal, professional success that I've not had to deal with it very much.
Maybe it's not attainable without legislative action at some point, but
so do
certainly
we
aspirational.
Think,
sorry, Jason.
I'm sorry. No, that's a really good point, though, about how do you work together. Will we have a Smarter Act or a One Agency Act or one of these whatever named act? Will we have this in the next 100 days or so or not?
I think there is a strong possibility that the One Agency Act could pass and be signed early in the next Congress, but ultimately that will be the decision for the probably, which we don't want to get into right now, the Senate parliamentarian, about whether this is actually possible, and I'll let Tom expand on that if he ultimately wants to. But there are
very
complicated rules about whether and how something can or cannot pass Congress and ultimately have the votes.
I think the One Agency Act is the right answer, and Alex mentioned the Smarter Act. It's the kind of incremental step. If you don't want to go to the One Agency Act, Smarter Act at least marries the two standards across the agencies. For a variety of reasons, as Michael talked about, people like to keep their authority on big, sexy things, and that's probably true across the government and business. So, there are folks who have interest in not having an agency go away. But hopefully, we can get to the right answer and move something forward.
Okay, you heard it here. Let's pivot. Unless anybody has anything further on that, I'd like to ask you about AI. Everybody always wants to talk about AI all the time. The current FTC has expressed concerns about AI's potential to automate discrimination and entrench surveillance, raising fundamental questions about power and governance. To what extent should antitrust be used to combat unfair discrimination? Is that a proper goal? I know Alex was talking more broadly about non-economic goals earlier.
Can I start on AI?
Sure.
Because I'd actually like to tie in our last discussion about clearance to AI and just talk about how backwards it is that we have two agencies right now. According to reports, which none of us know the answer, because again, it's people like Michael and others at the FTC doing this in back rooms, but AI has been split.
But remember, I don't do clearance.
You don't do clearance. You've been kicked out. So Michael's colleagues that kicked him out of the room are doing these discussions, but none of us know the answer. But according to public news reports, leaks from the agencies, they have split AI. And although the FTC just a few years ago did a big merger related to NVIDIA, NVIDIA is now being investigated by the DOJ, again, reporting according to reports. And Microsoft and OpenAI are being investigated by the FTC because the two agencies both wanted, I think how Michael put it, the big sexy cases. Neither of them wanted to give up. So are they sharing resources? Are they using their expertise, everything they're learning about AI, all of the expert staff that are developed or have been developed at the FTC when looking at that merger? No. They're both doubling their work and their understanding of AI. The same thing happens when they split up the big tech cases. There are people looking at platforms, and they are in two separate buildings and two separate agencies not working together. It doesn't make sense to approach the big, powerful monopolies in this way. And then on AI, I think ultimately it is a innovative, fast-moving market. I think the approach should be that we want a lot of competition in it. We want policy and enforcement that supports more competition, which means more players in the industry. If we get to a position where AI is developed by one player the way search is dominated by Google, that is going to be a not optimal outcome for all of us. So whatever concerns the government has, if they're worried about discrimination or bias and they want to regulate and do a lot, we need to make sure whatever they do does not lead to one, two, maybe three companies being the ones that can actually meet the burdensome regulations. We want more AI, not less AI, if ultimately we want good products that people actually want to use.
I agree with Adam's points. Going back to Judge Elrod's, the part of her question about unfair discrimination, I think the answer is no, and it's because neither agency has the authority to do so. At the FTC in particular, we've seen the majority for the last 4 years try to use unfair discrimination as a new authority to attack practices that historically were not under the purview of the FTC in a way to turn the FTC into a civil rights regulator. Commissioner Holyoake has a dissent in a case called Coulter that talks about this particular situation. And so I think absent congressional legislation, I don't see how the FTC would have the authority to prescribe that type of conduct in that setting. But I also agree with Adam's points, too, in the sense that we need to be very careful with a nascent technology that's just starting to get going, one that will have international ramifications were we to prevent it from growing in a way that it otherwise would.
Adam's point about the analog to search is well taken, right? because when you think about, first of all, AI, we talk about AI, but what is AI? There's a lot of inputs to AI. There's a computing power behind AI. There's the machine learning aspect of AI. And how do you access AI? Well, you're accessing it through your mobile device and sometimes probably your desktop when you're sitting at home. At least initially, that's how ChatGPT is. And it's probably going to be the same for other AI-related things. Apple just rolled out, I'm sure you've seen the commercials, the AI on your iPhone. So we do not want AI to be search, and then 20 years from now, us litigating monopolies in AI. Like, that is a terrible situation to be in. So how do you prevent that? Well, the search complaint that DOJ put out in the first Trump administration that Alex was in charge of and I worked on as well, was really important to talk about access points. Google locked down the access points to search, and that's how they maintain their monopoly. So are the incumbent players in search and big tech going to leverage their current positions into AI and lock down access points and gain an advantage? I think that's what we need to look at, and I think that's hopefully what the agencies are doing. But again, as Adam said, the wealth of knowledge is not being shared across FTC and DOJ.
I would agree with that. I think that there are laws that are better suited to dealing with your question specifically, Judge, on unfair discrimination, that are more efficient, that are going to be more targeted, maybe the consumer protection laws, other types of laws. So I think I would prefer that we refrain from trying to expand antitrust to encompass an area like unfair discrimination that is likely better gotten at through other law enforcement means.
So, sorry.
Don't be sorry. This is helpful.
I think this conversation is really interesting in a number of ways, but let's start the discussion on AI. There's been a lot of, it's complicated. There are lots of problems. There are lots of issues. Probably the agencies don't have the requisite expertise. And I would agree with that. And the one thing I would agree with that is, the one thing we should not be applying to AI are the 1993 healthcare guidelines on information sharing. But apparently we should, because we shouldn't have pulled down any guideline once it's there. We should just give people, if you comply with the safe harbors in any guideline, we can never sue you again. I mean, the reason those guidelines came down is because the world is a very different place than it was, and rather than giving people false comfort, we pulled them down. On to your question, Judge, I entirely agree that the way the antitrust laws work, fundamentally, if I have to explain them on one foot, is the antitrust laws prevent the inappropriate accumulation or use of monopoly power. And yes, inappropriate carries all the weight there, but that's always what we're talking about. So if you're saying we don't care what the cartel does, how it exploits its market power, it could exploit it by raising prices. It can exploit it by eliminating how they compete on quality. So could it be that you get together and you collude on certain sort of DEI policies? I mean, I've never seen anything that I think rises to an antitrust law, but like if it does, it's not because it's DEI, it's not because it's discrimination, it's because you have the reduction of competition that otherwise the market should determine it. Right, but I'm really struggling, Adam, to figure out how your concern that companies are colluding on DEI is not precisely the type of non-economic values I just heard everybody criticize for the agencies doing.
So I think my two examples were ESG and advertising collusion that we looked into, and the ESG collusion was to cut output of oil and gas to raise prices for consumers, and the advertising collusion was a group boycott to cut off the advertising spend, monopsony claims, buying of advertising to limit the output of conservative media. They're targeting conservative media. They were targeting certain platforms as well, which I think directly relates to a consumer harm, not some social welfare. I think we actually hear social welfare as the excuse that we got in these investigations. We needed to. All of the big financial institutions and asset managers needed to save the environment. All these big advertisers needed to make sure what good speech and bad speech was or was not online. I guess we're going back to the monopsony kind of discussion here and about how there seemed to be confusion about tying this to consumers. I mean, we can look at what the Department of Justice has actually done. the Penguin Random House case was a monopsony case. But what you said there is that you would pay authors less, and that would lead to less books or less quality books. Mm-hmm. That hurts consumers, ultimately.
No, that's not what we said. It was sufficient, and we were very clear, that merely reducing the salary to authors based on the elimination of competition is a sufficient condition for violating Section 7 of the Clayton Act. We'd never made any claims about, and because to the degree those claims exist, I mean, they were almost non-existent given how many books are bought and sold every year. That was purely about this is a merger that eliminated substantially competition for authors, and it violated Section 7.
Based on the opinion that I think came out from the judge, it is not clear to me that if there was no theory, and they discussed this, I think both you and the parties, obviously, the DOJ and the opinion, discussed that the consumers would be harmed by the monopsony power to pay authors less. That is in the opinion, so it's certainly there. I mean, I don't know if you're going to argue that it's dicta. I don't think it was.
It is dicta. And, you know, again, tell me where in Section 7 it says substantially reducing competition only matters if it applies to consumers.
Yeah, that is not in – consumer welfare standard is not in any of these statutes. Again, you mentioned Judge Bork, how he did a lot of work 45 years ago now, over probably 50 years ago now, to define antitrust around consumer welfare. And what he meant by it was actually not what we think of consumer welfare at all. Actually, the consumer welfare standard that we practice in antitrust for my entire career is not Judge Bork's consumer welfare standard that he put in there. And this is exactly how I started my opener, by saying antitrust is not static. Antitrust develops as we understand modern markets and modern analysis. And what consumer welfare standard is, it's not a test. It doesn't have a list of factors. It doesn't have a list of elements that you have to meet. It means that if you harm consumers, that is how you show, in theory, an antitrust harm. And that is how what common law created, not in the statutes, common law created way to win an antitrust case. And it's not...
Wait, which case says that? Which case says that? We have Supreme Court case law from the 20s, still good law, that focuses solely on the impact of a reduction in competition to suppliers, and without any discussion about the ultimate impact on consumers.
Yes.
Drug wholesalers. Where was the evidence that that merger would have risen, increased prices to consumers? Because the only evidence in that record was it wasn't going to.
Correct. So everything that has happened from consumer welfare standard is post right around 1980 case law. That is the shift in the case law. And the judges, largely at this Supreme Court level and circuit court level, are just discussing that antitrust law is a consumer welfare prescription. And it is not the only way to win a case. It is, I would argue, the best way to win a case, and showing harm to consumers is the way that we have won most cases that are actually litigated. But we still have per se violations, where you don't show harm to consumers at all. And when we're talking about monopsony, I'd still argue that the theory is there that the monopsony harms that we have actually won a case about in court, the judge was comforted by a harm to consumers. But when you say wage fixing, that should be per se illegal, and you don't have to tie it to any harm to consumer. So we can continue to develop.
Confused. Then what does it mean to say it's all about the consumer and then say, but if you wage fix, it's not. We don't really care about the effect on consumer.
Because
the statute's about competition.
Right.
And it doesn't care. The statute does not care where that competition occurs. If you by agreement or exclusionary conduct are reducing competition, you are in violation of the antitrust laws, full stop. We can talk about how you prove that, but that is what the statute and the case law says. If you don't agree, cite me chapter and verse of binding precedent that says that's not true.
I think we are talking about how do you prove these cases. How do you win these cases in court? That's what we're trying to prove. And obviously litigants were incredibly successful around the 1980s in saying this is not anti-competitive, and judges found it very, very convincing to how to put some sort of standard, some sort of target to point at if you don't show harm to consumers. You might be able to win this case. We might see this in the Kroger-Albertsons case. There's two theories there that I see. I think it is primarily focused on grocery prices, and that's going to harm consumers. But there's also a labor union-related claim that I don't know if the FTC is going to try to relate to consumer harm.
But
we will see if it is successful.
But to your point earlier, Adam, it's not static, right? Competition is a process. So, I mean, strictly speaking, you're right. If you have a price-fixing agreement, you don't have to show harm to consumers. But it's the type of agreement that we know that is an anathema to the competitive process. So I think to Adam's point earlier, it's not static. We understand that there are certain types of conduct that impede the competitive process, even absent direct evidence, right? So I don't think it's simply the case. I don't think it's fair to suggest that the consumer welfare standard, if we don't have direct evidence of harm to consumers, that ends the inquiry. It's the type of conduct that we know that ultimately could undermine competition as we understand it, that could ultimately lead to more innovation, helpful to consumers, et cetera, et cetera.
I agree with all of that. I do not agree that the law says you have to, you think that this is going to have a downstream effect. So going back to where we started, It is often the case in a monopsony case that if the downstream market is competitive, you would expect no impact downstream because you have no pricing power downstream. The only harm would be to the suppliers or the workers. Still, I do not see anything in the law that suggests, therefore, you can price fix as long as you can show the court that it's downstream. We couldn't harm consumers anyway.
But it's the type of conduct still that impedes the competitive process, right?
Right.
So that's
the point. Competitive process, I believe, is exactly the right standard.
But the reason why we have a competitive process is because we know the competitive process ultimately benefits consumers. That's the whole idea behind it. That's why we don't have rate fixing. We could just have a situation where, you know, we just have a bunch of competitors and we set prices and the government can do that, right? That's a way to organize the economy's resources. But we know that competition on the merits is a better way of doing it. And so the consumer welfare standard says let's go out and prescribe the type of conduct that impede that process, right? And now if what you're saying is that the government should be in the business of prosecuting cases that have nothing to do with consumer harm, then let's just say that and have that debate, if that's what you think the law should say. But
That is what the law says.
I think
a merger that reduces monopsony is anti-competitive. But it is anti-competitive, and it has nothing to do with – you do not – we – when we enforce the law, here's what I would say the big difference is. For 50 years, the antitrust bar decided that they were the Congress, and they were going to impose certain policy value judgments. We don't do that. The statute says a merger is illegal if it may substantially reduce competition in any area of the country, in any line of business.
I have a very different reading of the history than you do. That if you're suggesting that prior to 1980 that the agencies weren't in the business of being the legislators, I don't think that. But anyway.
Well,
so
let's. Why don't we bring the audience into this discussion? I bet they might have some questions, and there are some microphones at the back in the room, and we have a question right here. Can you state your question really loudly if you're not at the microphone? You can ask really loudly.
Mercatus Center, George Mason University, former general counsel, Federal Trade Commission. One thing that hasn't been raised is the FTC's efforts to advance competition rulemaking under Section 60 of the FTC Act. There's litigation right now over a proposed rule on, and the question really there, of course, is the FTC is seeking to regulate a large portion of the economy through non-compete clauses, in effect saying that non-compete clauses violate Section 5 of the FTC Act. There's a whole argument that should antitrust.
We'll see how the courts rule on this, but should historically antitrust has been case by case litigation under the rule of reason or in certain cases per se rule. It has not involved ex ante regulation. And now the FTC is trying to do something ex ante regulation, which the Justice Department certainly isn't able to do. Should ex ante regulation, FTC regulation play any part in antitrust policy and antitrust enforcement.
So, thank you. Anyone want to take that on?
Sure, Judge, I will. So a few things. First, I think the non-compete rule is a good example of, you know, a type of, for lack of a better phrase, law enforcement that is not consistent with the consumer welfare standard. And anybody who wants to have an understanding of the infirmities of that rule and why it is the commission doesn't have the authority, please read Commissioner Holyoake's erudite opinion on that.
Okay. Anyone else want to say anything on that before we move on?
Can't say anything about the FTC, so.
Okay. We'll take a question from back here.
Hi. So who knew that antitrust would create such a spirited discussion?
Indeed.
I have two questions. One regarding the FTC and the Department of Justice issue, having the two agencies review these types of situations. I happen to work in the insurance industry, and most insurance are regulated at the state level. And so if a company is, does business in 50 states, there's kind of a duplication of effort in trying to figure out if the insurance company is going to go insolvent. And you want to prevent insolvencies because it's bad for the consumers because they don't get their claims paid. Does that duplication of effort inform why it might not be a bad idea to have two agencies sort of reviewing antitrust situations? Because it's possible you might miss something, one agency might miss something that the other one could catch.
I'm sorry, I just couldn't hear you. Could you just repeat the question?
You're talking about having two agencies review and whether that can be beneficial?
Yeah, right. I was just saying that. I'm not sure what you didn't catch, if it was everything, but I was saying in the insurance industry, if an insurance company does business in all 50 states, there's insurance companies regulate insurance companies for, among other things, solvency. They want to make sure that the insurance company is going to be around to pay claims, and it's in the interest of the consumer to do so. And a duplication of effort, once 49 states might miss something that one state would catch and say, we need to step in and make sure that this company stays solvent. Does that example, transfer to the whole the antitrust issue, having two agencies oversee the antitrust claim?
Somebody to come behind to sure. help on really important matters.
So I think that it's, thank you for the question, sir. So I think that it's it'd be difficult to get efficiencies, right, that actually would yield the result that you're looking for. In other words, the agencies typically don't work together on the same matter, reviewing the same set of facts. There are some exceptions, but they typically don't do that. And so it would, in effect, be doubling up the number of people across the agencies along with the respective agencies' bureaucracies before getting to an answer on a question like yours. And so ultimately, I think that might be a potential problem. They generally are using the same analytical tools across the agencies when looking at issues. Again, there are some differences, but they are applying the same rules generally and the same tools generally. And so as a result, having just one agency look at an issue like yours should be sufficient. And I don't know that there would be enough gains from having both agencies that would outweigh the inefficiencies that would come with that.
Okay, question two quickly. When you hear the word monopoly, I think most people, when they have an opinion about it, they think it's necessarily bad. Is there a situation when you have an antitrust question that comes up that somehow maybe that the a monopoly actually might be a good outcome?
Thanks for the question. I mean, patents, right, is one area that comes to mind where when someone has issued a patent, that's a monopoly for a certain period of time. I think that's probably a good. I think we'd all agree that it incentivizes innovation, incentivizes investment in developing new things for our economy and bringing new drugs to market and new technologies. So I think patents is actually probably one of the ones that stands out where a monopoly is a good thing, certainly for a period of time.
Thank you. Sir?
Thank you for the lively discussion. Thank you to the panel. As a civil rights lawyer, most of it was above my head, but my question is concerning North Carolina Dental. It's been 10 years since that decision was issued. And there was a lot of hope at the time that you would see antitrust suits go after governments. My question is, why has that revolution not happened, and what can civil rights plaintiffs like myself do to make that happen?
I think it's a great question, and it goes to this issue of not only first principles, but how you direct agency staff resources, right? When probably the best FTC chairman was Tim Muris, and that's something that he focused on, right?
Excuse me? Really, sorry? We now have to go fight afterwards.
That's fine. I'm happy to.
You probably win because you're in better shape. But.
I think that, you know, and Senator Cruz also said it the other day, which gives me good persuasive authority. So to your question, though, you have to have leadership that, you know, directs the staff to do those types of things, right? And I think that, you know, it's always and everywhere. I mean, going back even to, you know, the Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith's, you know, key insight there was government was the problem when it comes to monopoly, right? Government could provide license, could provide charters, and you could come and curry favor with government in order to impede and otherwise, you know, undermine the competitive process, right? So I think that's a, you know, it's a great question, a great point, and hopefully it'll be on the minds of the leadership for, you know, in the next administration.
You, briefly, because it's a, it can also be brought by private plaintiffs, do you have any tips on how one ought to go about bringing antitrust claims against governments?
My hourly rate is, no, I'm just joking. I don't think I'm actually allowed to answer that question, actually.
So, I actually was at the Commission for North Carolina Dental. I think, right, it is a question of priorities. I think Tim Yours was one of the best FTC chairmen. It was because I worked for John Leibowitz.
He was also a very good chair.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Yes. Yes. But he also disagrees with the last 4 years.
I don't think so.
I don't know. Just not,
hasn't said anything to me, and we talk weekly.
We'll do the conference call after this.
And Tim Mears was very concerned about state monopolies, and that was his agenda, and he accomplished a lot. When John Leibowitz became chair, his top priority on the competition side was patent settlements that he felt were clearly anti-competitive and costing consumers tens of billions of dollars. That's what he chose. You can look at what we've brought. You can look at what the FTC brought. That's what we value. My response is, if you want more of those suits, give us more money. You know, we're not afraid. You know, we are not afraid to bring more cases, but we only have a limited budget. Elections have consequences. People who are in charge make those enforcement decisions, and you can't do everything.
Okay, we have a question. Yep. Do you want, if you care to, you can identify yourself in your city, but you don't have to.
Yeah, I'm Michael Glacken, and I work at Dow. So I'm in the capital allocation business, and I just, my quick comment before I ask my question is to say that Thomas, you are exactly correct that rhetoric matters for people who allocate capital. My question is directed more towards Adam. Adam, you mentioned oil and gas, trade associations, and lack of capital expenditures in the industry, which has increased prices. Would you be open to the idea, though, that maybe the causation isn't as clear as maybe you implied? And what I mean by that is it possible that investors have imposed their will on these companies, that you need to have better capital discipline in your planning? And the oil and gas industry has typically been one of peaks and troughs and busts. And large allocators of capital have come and said, we do not like your return on capital because you invest when demand is high for unanticipated demand that hasn't been realized. So is it possible that shareholders have gotten control of the companies and saying you will not invest capital based upon anticipated demand, but only on realized demand?
So shareholders should have control of public corporations, and they should follow all the SEC laws. Under the antitrust laws, what should not happen is a bunch of powerful asset managers or any powerful companies should not come together and collude and decide something in a way that harms consumers. So it is absolutely true that there are tons of SEC laws that give asset managers powers and certain rights to impact public corporations in this way, to make shareholder resolutions and to vote and to force people who invest with them to vote through proxy. Largely people don't. So they have this power. I absolutely agree in that way. But the antitrust laws absolutely can step in when this seems to be a cartel that is going to harm consumers without a justification.
Okay. Does anyone else want to answer that? Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Ethan Yang. I'm with the Cato Institute and was a legal intern at the FTC during law school, so perhaps I fetched you guys a coffee at one point during your tenure. My question's about the advertising boycott and the ESG issue. So I'm wondering, how would you distinguish, if you're going to bring a case, how would you distinguish that from, say, a trade association where, you know, companies do come together and discuss, like, what products they want to buy or what products they don't want in their product, right? So, like, there is a permissible collusion exception for the trade association. So I'm wondering, you know, how do you, when does liability attach when you're trying to go after this question of the group boycott when it sort of looks and smells like a, you know, almost like a trade association, companies deciding, like, okay, this is good for us collectively.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, we have to look at every antitrust case and the facts of that case to see how it works with the law. I think the specific example that you're looking at, I shouldn't say specific example, but the area you're looking at regarding the invention of a product that requires standards, and we have a whole area of antitrust law that looks at the declaration of standard essential patents and what requirements are required of that of people involved in those trade associations. So there is a lot of antitrust law developed around that area to make sure collusion doesn't happen, to make sure that products actually can be created. I think that's a lot different than the vague areas that the cartels that I'm talking about are trying to fix. And antitrust has largely focused on those areas where it's very specific collusion and price fixing and the things I mentioned before. And what I'm saying is that when other powerful actors are getting together, the antitrust enforcers need to take a close look at that. I mean, again, at Congress, we investigate for legislative purpose, not for criminal or civil penalties. So it is going to take a antitrust enforcer to really dive into this, or for a civil lawsuit, and some civil lawsuits in this area are ongoing. But it is going to be a different area of law that develops than naked restraints of trade or standard essential patent and FRAND area.
Okay. I think we probably have a fine question coming.
Hi, I'm J.P. Olinsky. I work at Cleary Gottlieb. I wanted to ask about the kind of trend to the sort of increased relative importance of qualitative information like company statements, internal presentations, things like that, relative to economic modeling and data, and just how durable you think that trend is, and maybe part of that is the extent to which that is a shift in judicial thinking versus a shift in the way the cases are being brought and argued and things like that.
So it's interesting that you say that, because the history of merger enforcement, the government wins when it has good documents and good admissions, because that's who wins most cases. You know, and I mean, this is just, you know, I honestly think, like, this issue is not an issue. It's people argue the best facts they have. And when they have good economics, that's what they use, or when they think they have good economics. But you can have bad data. You can be doing bad econometrics. There's lots of reasons why. You know, I don't see there's a difference. Like, whatever happens in every single case I've ever seen is, if the government has good econometrics and the defendants have good anecdotal evidence, the defendants are up there saying, why are you listening to these pinhead academics? Look at the way we operate. That's what they should do. That's exactly right. That's conversely, when we have really good economics, we, you know, try to put on the most powerful economists we can have to explain why there's a problem. I think that is really not something that changes. It changes based on the cases, and you know, yeah.
The only change that I think that I've seen is that people are relying at the agencies a little more on qualitative evidence that they think is favorable for them, even in circumstances where maybe, like, they're looking at the economic side of the deal and they think it's actually not that much of a problem deal, right? But if we layer on top harmful sort of qualitative, you know, documents, things like that, we can get this over the line. So that's really what I've seen more of a shift to, whereas at least in my sense was historically, there was a dialogue with the agencies, like especially on deals, we were talking about potential merger, and there was a discussion about, well, ultimately what is going to be the impact of this deal, right? And there was maybe disagreement about that from an economics perspective, and qualitative evidence would also help in evaluating that. But now it's like, maybe I'll call it the closer calls, right, seem to be leaning more towards relying heavily on qualitative evidence, even if the economics maybe doesn't support a case or maybe barely supports a case.
And one point, having litigated a few of these cases in front of judges make a credibility determination of the witnesses, and that's the economists and that's the executives. And you can have a great model, but if you can't explain it in plain language that makes sense to a federal judge who may not have a background in economics, you're not being effective. I worked on the AT&T Time Warner trial for DOJ, and our economist, Judge Leon, referred to his model as a Rube Goldberg contraption. You're probably not going to win the case if that's what the judge is saying, but I think it works for executives too, right? If you have terrible documents for the merging parties and the executives say that the merger is going to create a monopoly and there's all these graphics in the documents, and then they get on the stand and they spin a different story, I think federal judges can discern credibility pretty easily. So it's a factual distinction that judges are going to have to make that call, and I think they're pretty good at doing that.
So just to give you a couple anecdotes, right, or one anecdote, right? Probably one of the sort of stellar antitrust cases of economic empiricism was the first FTC versus Staples, which slightly predated me. Except if you read right, there were two massive, very well-known economists testifying against each other, right? What the FTC, and the FTC essentially proved that office superstores are a market, which they were laughed at the time, and now everyone would say that was a brilliant case. But if you look at what the judge relied on, didn't talk about the economics. He was like, that's a wash. He looked at how the business was operating. So that goes to the point that it is always, I don't think it has ever been the case that we value different types of evidence because there are different cases and certain types of economics is better than others. But I entirely disagree with Alex that we do not think about economics. I mean, if we did not, I would wonder why Susan Athey, who won the John Bates Clark Medal, which amongst economists is more impressive than the Nobel Prize, why she was at the agency. We literally arguably found the best Iowa economist in the world to come to the DOJ, right? So, like, I just think you want to criticize our decisions, you want to say our understanding of competition's wrong, that's fine. That's more power to you, but really to suggest in any way that we are less serious in this administration about economics is, I think, a gross and unfair misrepresentation.
Well, it's definitely what I've seen, and not necessarily from you, Michael, or DOJ, but I've seen it in dealing with the FTC, where there is a definite downplaying of the economics, where they don't favor an agency case. And I also think that, you know, by pushing merger guidelines, these new ones that have sort of an arbitrary cutoff at 30%, you know, combined share of the parties plus a delta of 100 of HHIs.
So isn't that Philadelphia suggests, National Bank
that suggests,
literally?
Yeah,
isn't that literally what the Supreme Court said?
No, no. And what we have learned since then is that what we have learned since then, Michael, is that 30% is only relevant in certain circumstances, right? It is not relevant in most circumstances. Right, the share
no,
is determined by the share.
I disagree actually, with that.
Right, but by setting that presumption there, irrespective of whether you're citing to authority, right, by setting that presumption there, you're creating significant problems for parties that are getting in front of the agencies, and it's suggesting that you're not going to be doing a nuanced economic analysis to determine whether or not there's actually harm to competition by virtue of the market shares. What it suggests is, if I can get it to 30%, if I can figure out a relevant market that'll allow me to get 30%. I'm going to go in and argue for a presumption, and the court will potentially side with me.
Right? Because like that's
the Supreme Court approach. Said. That's a different approach.
The Supreme, it's about was, fidelity
specific,
to the law.
That was a specific case with a specific set of facts, right? It is not an arbitrary line.
Absolutely
and
it is.
And it's never been set as an
and
arbitrary line.
And which
by the
case did the Department of Justice bring that fits that? What cases have we brought that we barely cleared 30% and said, judge, it's 30%, we lose? We
again, that was a case that I was involved in with the FTC.
Okay, I literally
so I know you're not at the FTC. You
justify
can't speak to
the
it,
FTC.
Right?
That's all
why
I can say is,
I haven't had that issue with
if
you
want to
DOJ,
come at the Department of Justice and say this administration was not as sophisticated or more sophisticated than any other antitrust administration, give me chapter and verse and we'll talk.
Right, and what I'm suggesting is, so A, my issue is with the FTC. I had that issue recently, which is why I raised it as something that I've seen, okay? I, again, expressly said I haven't seen it with the DOJ in a case. But what I'm suggesting is that by focusing on the 30% cutoff and reverting back to old guidelines from the 80s where there was a 30% cutoff, it suggests that you're not willing to consider sort of a nuanced economic analysis and market share analysis with respect to each deal because, as we know, the facts are different in each deal, and those facts should drive the analysis, right, the relevant market analysis. And so that's all I'm suggesting. And so I'm assuming DOJ still signs off on those merger guidelines, right? And so by having contributed to that, it suggests that you are less serious about the economics, that you're hewing more to, as you've cited, to Philadelphia National
Bank.
So
and literally you're saying Susan Athey, winner of the John Bates Clark Medal.
I'm not criticizing
that
Susan.
She doesn't believe in economics because merger guidelines, she was the driving force.
She is not the frontline attorneys at, for example, the FTC that I dealt with. Okay? There's a very big difference. I know Susan Athey. I like Susan Athey. We worked together before. It is not a criticism of Susan Athey.
Do the attorneys always listen to the economists?
And very often the economists.
They listen to the guidelines, and the guidelines were the brainchild of Susan Athey and Aviv. Yeah,
I don't think anybody's criticizing her, though. So
yeah, we're not criticizing her.
Well, right, because it sounds a little ridiculous for an attorney to start taking on maybe the smartest Iowa economist in the world. But yeah, that's why you're not.
I'm making a point based on
Our time
personal
is
observations and things that I've dealt with. That's it, Michael.
This is really terrific that you're all so engaged. We have our time is running short, and we have a couple of questions, and I would like to get to them if possible.
So in recent years, we've seen the FTC file suit against Qualcomm for its SEP standard essential patent licensing practices, and some FTC commissioners have filed statements opposing exclusionary relief for SEP holders. But at the same time, over the last 10 years, patent rights have gotten substantially weaker than they were, and there's been a concentration in the licensee market, particularly in the phone market. Is there any concern on the panel that the market power is now on the side of – there's too much market power on the side of the purchasers of the technology in those markets rather than the owners of the technology?
By purchasers, do you mean the companies buy?
Yeah, I mean the companies that need licenses to the patents. Essentially, can the people that need the licenses drive down the license prices so that they can reduce the cost of the input to their products and stifle innovation?
Patent law is a policy decided by hopefully elected officials that grant a monopoly to someone. This is all of our IP law. And we take the good and the bad we think it's going to accelerate innovation, but it's also giving someone a monopoly ultimately. I think antitrust enforcers need to understand that within that area of the law and the regulations around it, that is the market, understand the market, understand there might be a monopoly, and respect property rights, but it's certainly a balance that has to be done. We want both the holders of patents to have their rights, and we want companies to be able to license those patents and ultimately sell them to consumers at a good price. It's a difficult balance to have.
Okay.
So my answer would be if that's the problem, that's a problem. And as an enforcer, I'm worried about that problem. It does not matter to me whether it's the patent holders violating the antitrust laws or the licensees. It's whether are they abusing their monopoly power, which they can do stuff with patent holders have certain rights, but they're not. It's not a free check on the law, and so whether it's the licensors or the licensees creating the problem, if it's an antitrust violation, it's an antitrust violation. Full stop.
Okay, this may be our last question. What is the question?
Hi, my name is Matt Stoller, and I would like to ask you a question about monopolization law. But first I want to make an observation, which is that I'm a Democrat, and I think we ran as the party of expertise. So it's nice to hear a complete inversion in here about economists. So from 1998 until 2020, there were no major monopolization cases from the DOJ. There were a few from the FTC. Didn't really have many in the private bar. And I sort of started paying attention to antitrust around 2012 or so. And the argument that I started to hear was, oh, this is because the judges would never allow it. And one argument from Carl Shapiro in 2017 was there weren't any monopolization cases that we saw that could meet the legal standard that we should use to bring a case. And I think, you know, the Trump administration towards the end changed that, and I think the Biden administration has gotten much more aggressive with monopolization law. I'm wondering, given what we've seen and some judges starting to say, yes, monopolization law can apply in certain contexts, why do you think there weren't any monopolization cases from 1998 to 2020? Or there were, but they were very, very minor, certainly none in the area of big tech or important economic parts of our society.
Thank you. Any takers?
I'll go first, but I'm sure everyone wants to say something. You know, I think if you look at you said they weren't major. If you look at the companies or the issues that would have been major in that time span, I think it's largely big tech. And I think we all know that personnel is policy when it comes to these issues. And I just wonder when people would have expected those to have come and come faster. I think during the Bush administration, those enforcers certainly were not thinking about big tech probably that much, certainly not when they were being confirmed or being vetted. And then I think the Obama administration came around, and I don't think it's any secret how close the Obama administration was with tech. And if you're thinking about you're the assistant attorney general, you're probably acting on behalf of the president, you're probably not going to act if you think that's not something the president wants you to do. And then the Trump administration came and they began the investigations. They take many years. But ultimately, if you think about it in terms of presidential administrations and policy, it makes sense why it took so long to bring those cases. I think the other aspect of it is we were largely focusing on the FTC or relying on the FTC to bring conduct cases, and the DOJ was more focused on merger cases for most of the way its structure was. And there were conduct cases in the FTC, a few of them, but maybe they didn't raise to what you would view as major or significant. But I'm reading a little bit into your question there in terms of what I would consider major, and that would be my best guess about why they weren't a little bit earlier in the big tech space.
Not just big tech. I'm talking about the entire economy. So just thank you. Appreciate the response.
Thank you.
So since I lived through that, what I think a big difference is that until 2016, there was not a political anti-monopoly movement. And for the time I was a staff attorney at the FTC, you never suffered a bad career by closing cases. If you brought a case and the agency lost it, you were sent off to some version of Siberia. So part of the issue is because this has become a public issue and a bipartisan one, the agencies can be far more aggressive, because it's not like if we lose the agency, we lose a case, we get our budgets cut. So I think that is point one. And I think sort of point two is that there was the ideology, we're all prisoners of the ideology we grew up with. And in some sense, right, if that period was a period where people were really hot to trot on thinking about empirical evidence of merger simulations. So that's what they knew, that's what we did, and it's really important. And I think it's about both, you know, this for agencies to realize that if you're thinking the same thing you thought 10 years ago, you're probably behind the times. So I would say those were the two reasons why we didn't see a lot of monopolization cases.
Okay. This is going to be it. Can you ask it really quickly?
Yes. What's the future of the merger guidelines, given that there's been a radical change, and both the change in substance, dominant firm, structural presumptions, and the change in form, trying to give a spin to various cases rather than just economic analysis? Will there be a revision to those guidelines?
Fortunately, I have no idea, and I will not be involved at all.
Does anyone have a
You know, obviously it remains to be seen, but I you mentioned the merger guidelines. I think it's also important to bring up the new HSR filing requirements. Those impose a heavy burden across all deals, not just the deals that could be problematic, which is typically in the second request form. So it's almost like a regulatory tax on smaller deals. So I think both of those will be at least reevaluated and perhaps changed or revoked.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think that there's a lot of interest and a lot of talk about potentially revising the most recent iteration of the guidelines.
Well, I have two more things to do. The first one is to make announcements that a book signing will take place for the Mises Revolution, the Making of a Constitutional Moment, by Professor Calabresi and Professor Lawson, and that's in the concourse level just after this program. And then we encourage you to visit the Remnants Trust Rare Documents exhibit, which is in the Cardozo Room on the terrace level. We will have a networking break until 3 o'clock, but we would be remiss indeed if we did not thank our incredibly engaged panel, Chris, Thomas, Adam, Alex, and especially Michael.